You're being vetted by the cat.
Oh, good. I hope I pass.
So far, so good.
I have a cat, not a dog.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what the cat's bringing up.
So
the question is, at what point did you realize that if you wanted to do the work you wanted to do and live the lives you wanted to live, you were going to need to be revolutionaries?
Well, I don't think either one of us decided to be a revolutionary. It is evolutionary to become a revolutionary. But I had an early wake-up call. I had been certified in the LCA, which was a predecessor body to the ELCA, and it involved an interview with a bishop in New York City, which was the synod I would have been assigned to. And in that interview, he questioned me about why I was a divorced person, and I told him half the truth, which was that I had married a gay man and it hadn't worked out. And he responded with a great deal of warmth and said, well, you will understand a number of people here in the Synod. I've had a number of gay men come out to their parishes, and it creates a mess, and I think that you could have a healing ministry here. And I heard that with, hearing the craziness of my own life in that response. And it was an interview that went very well, with me withholding part of the truth. And he welcomed me to the synod, and I walked out of that interview feeling absolutely crazy and stepped onto the steps of Fifth Avenue just as the Lesbian and Gay Freedom Day parade was pouring down Fifth Avenue. And I stood on the sidelines watching the sea of humanity waving placards that read, I'm gay and I'm proud. And I thought to myself, I certainly can't say I'm gay to this church, and I most certainly can't say I'm proud. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a watershed moment for me. I realized that I was about to do something that would just so totally split myself apart, that would drive a wedge between spirituality and sexuality and be very disintegrating, that I went back to Minnesota and couldn't bring myself to complete that process of getting ready for a call in Manhattan. And so I wrote my bishop in Manhattan and simply said that I needed an extra year to do some training in the field of chemical dependency treatment counseling, which was, again, half the truth. I did use the year to do that, but what I really needed to do was come to terms with the fact that I was about to make a huge mistake that would forever change my life. And
I'm sorry, that huge mistake was to be closeted.
To continue to be closeted. I was 34 years old by then, and I'd been rigidly closeted throughout my life. And it was as though coming to a fork in the road. I mean, I think it took a sea of humanity to confront me with the craziness of what I was doing. But I still wasn't able to fully act on it at that point. It took me another year, and it also took falling in love with Phyllis to make me realize that I needed to choose differently in my life, and that relationships I had in the past had been very damaged by my unwillingness to come out of the closet and come out to myself and others. So this was a chance to live life differently. And so when I got back to Minnesota, I allowed my certification to lapse and did pursue training in the field of chemical dependency and counseling, and also entered the graduate program in Masters of Ministry and Social Change. And I came out to my student group right away, the first day of the program, because I had been completely closeted in seminary and knew that I needed to be in order to get my Master of Divinity degree, because many of my contemporaries who had chosen to come out or who had been found out had been basically washed out quietly. But in the Masters of Ministry and Social Change, I just decided if I'm going to do that coursework, I'm going to do it completely out. And it was a very good experience. I wasn't seeking ministry at that point. I was just really trying to experience a year of being at seminary with some integrity to my life. Because, of course, closeting robs you of integrity and creates all kinds of problems for your relationships.
And Phyllis, how about for you? What was your decision about deciding that you two were going to need to really shake things up?
Well, since I had not been in a relationship before, I was really in the process of coming out to myself, which was really integrating a lot of this image of who's your true self, how do you put that together. And for me, meeting Ruth, falling in love with her, having already read her dad's books, having that already be a part of my faith journey in many ways, that was a revolution for me, and that really brought me to find my voice, find my deeper self in a way. And yet it still took me several years to do that publicly. And so since I was in seminary, when I met Ruth and when we got together, I stayed closeted through my senior year and graduated, but was not free to know how to live that out. I ended up spending almost a year in an interim ministry working with youth, which was not an ordained position at that point. And so again, was living out my dream of being a pastor, was greatly gifted in this relationship with Ruth, and yet couldn't feel the joy of it because I was disassociated from bringing all this together within myself. And so it was at that point that I realized this is absolutely crazy. So when that position ended with the youth ministry, I went to my bishop and just said, I can't. And Ruth accompanied me, and we sat there and told our story and said, I just can't live this fractured life. It's cutting me off from the source of integrity and joy and meaningfulness in my ministry, and it's sabotaging this relationship. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he was supportive in a private way, but said officially he needed to remove my name from the roster of eligibility. And so that was a time of great loss and grief for me in many ways. It really had been my dream and really was true to who I was. So I kind of did a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it was the miracle of God's revolution in our lives and in the world that who said, you know, I'm not quite done with you yet. And so it was almost 5 years later when we got a letter in the mail from our friend Anita Hill, ironically, who said, you know, I heard about this position in San Francisco. Here's the job notice, and they're looking for either a lesbian pastor or someone who is qualified, who has been certified, done all that, but the barrier was their sexuality. I think this is you and Ruth. I think you should apply. And that was the beginning of us receiving the call to St. Francis and being ordained in January of 1990.
I think that both of us had to be confronted with giving up the dream of ministry and to really let it go and to fully kind of radically claim the goodness of our lives and the wholeness of our lives while grieving the loss of ministry. But I think until we were ready to give it up, to give up what constantly tempted us to choose between spirituality and sexuality, and to reject that idea, and until we were ready to completely give it up, until we were ready to say no to it, we would never be ready to fully say yes to it, and so both of us did other things for 5 years, and we also needed to be completely out in our lives. We would not have been ready for the call to San Francisco had we not had those 5 years of healing and claiming the fullness of our lives and our relationships and being ready for a call that would require us to be very public in both our life and our work. Because the first year of our ministry, in San Francisco was a very, very public ministry that involved a great deal of advocacy and education in the wider church and advocacy on behalf of GLBT people who were trying to claim their lives in the midst of the epidemic of AIDS that was rocking the city. So we thought we gave up ministry only to discover that it reclaimed us in a better place in our lives.
Well, and I also, in that process, realized that I had confused the approval of the church with the deep acceptance of God's grace. And I think that once I figured out God works through the church, but the church is not God. And once I figured that out, it gave me great freedom and also, I think, really grounded me to be able to be in this position where the church needed to be active and alive in the lives of people, not just a building, not just doctrines, not authorities, but how does this get lived out in real people's lives? And I think that absolutely opened the door for that to happen for us.
So you were in the spotlight. You were the first out lesbian couple to be ordained in the Lutheran Church, or extraordinarily ordained. So you made history, and you were laughing. You've done countless interviews. I mean, what did that do for you to be in the spotlight like that?
Well, I think both of us knew acutely that we were representing populations of people who had been so marginalized by the church and rendered invisible and quite silent. I mean, it was not at all uncommon for people to just fade away, to be quietly forced out of their congregations if they were clergy and if they were simply members, or to feel as though they were so unwanted that it did harm to remain. And so we referred to them as the disappeareds. And so the weight of suddenly having a very public voice that represented the lives and histories of so many people was a serious burden and opportunity. And all the more so as the congregations that called us were brought up on charges and then brought to ecclesiastical trial. So by giving testimony in the trial, we knew that we were speaking on behalf of many, many people whom we didn't even know. And I would say that one of the things that strengthened me during that period was it was a 3-day trial, and before I gave testimony, one of the reporters for a San Francisco newspaper handed me a little chip and said, "Here, take this. It's a chip from the Berlin Wall. I think this is what you are all about, tearing down walls." And I had that chip in my pocket when I gave my testimony at the trial. And I don't think I have ever before or ever since felt so completely inspired in my testimony. I think that the Spirit was definitely present and fully at work, using me basically as a vehicle for what needed to be said.
And it was around that time that you now famously predicted how long it would take the church to catch up. Tell me about that prediction.
Well, it was a reporter who asked in one of our interviews. Oh, I'm sorry. I think you're going to have that in the background.
That's okay.
Okay. It was a reporter who asked us in one of our interviews how long did we think it would take the church to change its discriminatory policy. And I said I thought it would take about 20 years. And the reporter replied with some surprise. And I said, well, I was thinking of a friend of ours who said the church operates on geological time. and for a change to really take root. That isn't subject solely to the whims of a political atmosphere. Those kind of changes have to happen slowly, so that they have some possibility of sticking. You know, so they really reflect. At the same time, you have to be a catalyst for change, because left to our own devices, we are people. All of us tend to remain in our comfort zones, and anything truly worthwhile in life takes us out of our comfort zones. And this was an opportune time. It was just as the AIDS epidemic was a crisis in the city, it was also an opportunity, because it had reached such a point where it could no longer be ignored. And people wore T-shirts that said, "Silence equals death." They really understood that silence did equal death. And I think the church had relied on GLBT people to be complicitous in their own victimization up to that point. We were encouraged to disappear quietly, to sort of protect the shame associated with being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. And when GLBT people realized that silence equals death, and as we claimed our right to spirituality and sexuality and the gift of sexuality in our lives, we threw off shame and began truly, I'm losing the thread of my thought here. Hang on. Let's see. Well, I think the times made it a crisis of life or death. And probably without AIDS, it would have taken even longer. But we were waking up to the fact that we could not participate in our own victimization, in our own silencing. And so people came out. They came out as gay, they came out as lesbian, as as bisexual and transgender, and they came out as people with HIV, and lesbians stepped up to the plate and began to support their gay brothers who were rapidly losing their friendship networks as well as their partners. And it became a time when there was just no turning back. The church could not put a cork on that.
And I'm wondering, so Phyllis, you said, and I want to have you say it again because I'm worried about what I recorded on that first card, but you said you dreamed of becoming a Lutheran pastor since you were a child. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, you had such an uphill battle with the Lutheran church, but there were other congregations, other faiths, rather. You could have just jump ship to one where they wouldn't have such a fight, but you both chose to stay and try to change the Lutherans. Why did you decide that it was that important to you to stick with the Lutherans and make your fight there?
Well, certainly God is at work everywhere in the world, so it's not like God is only using the Lutherans, but I was born into the Lutheran tradition. I was baptized, confirmed Lutheran. I felt called to seminary and really came out to myself while I was in seminary. So it felt like this was who I was. And to have to take that away and say, well, that part has to be erased. You can move over to another denomination that may be more supportive. Just felt like it was somehow ripping out part of my heart and it just felt wrong. It just felt like this is who I am, and the integrity, the wholeness of this together, and was what was being used by God. And I think part of it is when we have difficulties in our lives or struggles, God uses those too, and that becomes our vulnerability, becomes part of our strength. It gives us compassion and understanding, and we understand that justice is important, and listening and learning, and we don't have all the answers, but we need to also speak up and say what we know and tell our truth and be present to one another. And it just felt like it was important to stay in kind of that spiritual family in a way, to not be kicked out of my own family, and not to be complicitous in saying that was okay. And it made it a struggle, and it was hard, and there were times when I really wasn't clear on whether that was the right decision, but I feel very blessed and fortunate that that I was able to persevere in that, and this is a very joyous time to be looking at how all of this has come together in ways that I don't think I ever would have predicted that it would.
And I think, too, when you're a change agent, you act in the arena in which you live. And some people do that in a secular arena, and they are activists. They're political activists, social activists. Well, our arena was the church, and I'm third generation clergy. My father was a Lutheran pastor and seminary professor. He retired the year before I started at the seminary that he taught. And so I think you just, you know, you bloom where you're planted, and or you become an agent for change where you're planted. And that was the direction that we were called to.
Just that in and of itself is fascinating, that you're third generation mm-hmm. clergy. And how did your father handle?
Oh, well, my father was a wonderful man who was he believed in the inherent worth of every human being, and his theology was very centered in God's grace and unconditional love. And that came from his father and his father's mother, who wrote her son letters from Denmark to Minnesota when her son became a pastor in southeastern Minnesota. I never met my grandfather or my great-grandmother, but I have those letters, and they are a spiritual legacy that really have taken root in our family. And unfortunately, my father was no longer alive at the time of our call to San Francisco, but we were out and fully received in by both my parents. Prior to his death, I came out when I was 34 years old, and so it was only 2 years that I had to be fully know and be known by my father. And that's one of the things that closeting does. It robs you of a dimension to relationship that is very sad to lose. And so I had 2 years to fully reclaim a relationship with my father that was built on integrity. And he was extremely supportive. His first response to my coming out to him and to mother was to say, "My, how much you must have suffered to have kept yourself a secret from us all these years." And then he simply affirmed their love for me, as did my mother as well. So at the time that my father was diagnosed with cancer 2 years after I came out to him, and I was with Phyllis at that point. Part of the reason I came out to him was that I knew that it was one thing to hide myself, it was another to hide what Phyllis meant to me. And so when we came out to him, after we came out to him, I'm sorry, back up. At the time of my father's diagnosis of cancer, he asked to meet with each member of his family, and he met with Phyllis and me together. And he basically told us how much we meant to him. And he said, "I am sorry that you live in a world that is so cruel in its ignorance, but I am not worried for you, because your problems will be external, not internal." And he said, "And I know that wherever you are, you will be doing ministry, because ministry is who you are." And this was after we had given up ministry. But we were both engaged in similar lines of work. I was working at Pride Institute, working with people who are chemically addicted, GLBT people who are chemically addicted. And Phyllis was working with children affected by AIDS through the Aliveness Project here in Minnesota. So we were continuing to do work that meant a great deal to us before the call came to San Francisco. But it was part of what prepared us for that call, I think. And meanwhile, my father died. But at the time of our extraordinary ordinations, my mother stood with her hands in blessing on our shoulders at our ordinations and was for the next 15 years of her life a vociferous activist on behalf of GLBT people in the Lutheran Church, particularly here in Minnesota.
You mentioned that you had, how should I say it? You're in San Francisco, you're there at the height of the AIDS crisis, and I noticed that you both work as chaplains now. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the path that mm-hmm. set you on, because you're not currently pastors in a church. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if you can talk about the sort of route that you've taken.
Well, so much of our work in San Francisco was centered on grief and loss support. There were people who came to our church, or there were gay male couples who came to our church, and they would say, one of them would say, I have AIDS, I need a community in which to die, and my partner needs a community in which to grieve. And so our congregation became known as a place of sanctuary, not only for people with AIDS, but also for their Midwestern fathers and mothers who would come out and spend their last few months with their sons before they died. And they would say, they were closeted back in their Midwestern parishes, the parents were, and they would talk about the grief of not being able to talk about their children whom they loved. And many of them would go back to the Midwest determined to come out on behalf of their gay sons with AIDS and to work for change within the church as well. When we moved back here, moving into hospice chaplaincy was not an unnatural move. It was kind of, I suppose, an extension of the grief and loss support that was so large part of our ministry in San Francisco. I work for Hospice of the Twin Cities, and I would say that one of the things that all of the people on the care team that I work for would say is that when you accompany people at the end of life and their families, you really stand on sacred ground with them, and you help them see the opportunities that are hidden in the burden of grief, the opportunity to speak truthfully to one another, to reconcile differences, to just give one another the gift of presence. And to heal through a deep level of acceptance, and to entrust, life is so complex. There are wounds in life that are too deep to heal fully in this life, and that just need to be entrusted to the work of eternity. And I think helping families realize that and just come together to be with one another, to bless one another, to be present in this life journey that eventually takes us out of life is a holy and sacred thing to do. Birth is a passage, and so is death. And each of them requires, just as birth requires welcoming arms, I think death requires sending arms of blessing. So a lot of the work that we do is really just helping people claim the goodness of love that travels with them.
Phyllis, I would love to hear you describe that connection
It's okay.
Between the work that you do and the fight that you've had over mm-hmm. sexual identity.
Mm-hmm. During the 3-day trial for St. Francis and First United Lutheran Churches, I couldn't stay to hear everyone's testimony. During the 3-day trial for First United and St. Francis Lutheran Churches, I was not able to stay through the whole trial and hear everybody's testimony because I was called to be with a man who was dying. And so it was just so entwined in all of our ministry. It's almost hard to remember how intense that grief was. We had a parishioner who said, you know, I stopped counting co-workers, loved ones, friends who died after 50. I just couldn't keep going. And that was within a year. I mean, it's hard to comprehend that much loss. So it was layer upon layer. You know, I was called into the nearby hospital where they came to know my work and would call me in. And, you know, it wasn't just our community. It was friends and people who had come from the Midwest who didn't have a place, and our community really became almost a hospice community, empowering them and walking with them. And so it really was sacred ground, walking the valley of the shadow, and having come from a place of my own sense of feeling previously hidden and disempowered and kind of caught in my own shame. And at that time, there really still was a shame message that was being given, that somehow you were sick, or you were evil, or you were just wrong somehow in God's eyes. And to be able to say, no, we're not here to pity you. We're here to accompany you and to bless you, and that you don't have to die feeling somehow shamed and rejected, but you can know that you are loved and cherished and respected. And I think that just came so deeply within me that it really seemed like an obvious thing to move into hospice ministry. Our years at St. Francis.
I just want to say what you're saying is so...
this is really
it's so hard.
We need to put them in the bedroom, or at least one of them. Really.
It's so sweet, but...
You're like,
I feel like it sort of contrasts
with the...
And then
there's this wrestling match in the background.
The somberness of what you're saying.
Yeah. Boy, it's interesting to really remember, because it's, you know, the context is so different now. And, you know, the religious voices were so caustic back then, too. So you just had, you know, it's hard to kind of remember the frame. And thank goodness it has changed, you know. We can see that it's better. You know,
I want to hear you talk about that.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
Because you can see that, you know, there's still opposition and there's still dissension. But we don't have that same harsh background of religious rejection. It was the moral majority. And just, I mean, when you think of it, it was just a very caustic, harsh, judgmental voice. And now, you know, there's still disagreement, there's still hurt, there's still divergence among us all, but it comes from a much more thoughtful place. We're looking at how do we look at scripture differently, what do we have to learn from each other, what's this common struggle that, you know, we're in this together. There are tensions between different parties, but it's not the hostility of really spiritual hatred, really, which is what it felt like for a while. So contrasting 20 years ago to now, I mean, I just have to say that, and we still struggle. I mean, obviously, we're looking at how do Muslims find a place in the spiritual respect and life in America, and kind of Midwestern, more Protestant, Catholic, Christian. We, you know, we all still struggle with what does that mean to keep stretching, to keep being open. But hopefully we can move beyond the I'm right, you're wrong, I'm blessed, you're cursed, and find a way that we're part of this spiritual fabric of God's presence in our lives in this wide world. And I'm encouraged from what I've seen, from where we started in this struggle to where we are now. I see a lot of hope.
when you, I guess I'm looking, I'm trying to think, like, when you sort of try to sort of pop out of your own lives and roles and sort of look down on this whole social revolution that you, that you've been a part of, I mean, what do you think is in play? Or what is this really about, when you listen to people debating sexual orientation in the church? I mean, I'm just curious for your take on, you know, what is the fear about, or why was this so threatening?
Well, I think humanity has always had difficulty with differences. We gravitate to our own kind. We gravitate to what looks like us and feels like us and talks like us and acts like us. And we all create our little, you know, we create our tribes over and over and over again. And I think the notion that differences can, well, differences always stretch us. And they take us out of our comfort zone. And that's true of anything that's truly worthwhile in life. And you can choose to go with that and learn from it and actually even enjoy the process of it and come to a point where differences can be not only tolerated but celebrated. And I think what we're seeing right now in the ELCA is this upcoming rite of reception is moving us beyond tolerance and into celebration of differences. We don't fully understand the differences among us yet, but we're willing to say something good can come of them if we open our hearts to one another and don't enter into it solely from the standpoint of adversarial fear. Now, clearly, when you have imbalances of power, part of what needs to happen is that when power is centralized, and as it is in this denomination, it's quite centralized, people have to come to an awareness of their own power, too, because shifts in power don't happen from the top down. They happen from the outside edges in. They happen on the grassroots level. And there's been a lot of change occurring on the grassroots level in the Lutheran Church until finally, you know, within our denomination, it has required a two-thirds vote to get us a sexuality study, the recommendations from a sexuality study passed. And I think that has helped make this, anchor this change, so that it's not just whimsical. Go ahead.
Well, I think we see family shifting. I think we see all kinds of things just changing in society. And, you know, you can never get the genie back in the bottle. Once you start talking about gay marriage, you can say, oh, you can't do it in this state, you can't do it in this state. No, that's not okay. But there are people who are finding one another. There are people who are building their lives together. There are people who have been together 20, 25, 40 years who, it doesn't matter what you call it, they are together. They are a family. They are a couple. And many of them have children. So that is a family. And so to say we want to get married, we want to be recognized, we want to have the same privileges and that everybody else has, because we already have the responsibilities of a family. We're not choosing those. We already have those. We're wanting to have recognition and support. Well, once that's already out there, you can fight it forever, but you're never going to be able to say it's not there. You're never going to be able to put that genie back in the bottle. And the same thing was true with as we were talking about reflecting on when the AIDS crisis was so prominent, especially when we were in the Bay Area. And, you know, when it was clear that silence equals death, and once you say that, well, then your voice equals life. Then visibility equals support and transformation. And once that's out there, then again, there's no going back. And I think that's what's been happening with gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people in the church, that once that visibility came forward, well, then it's always a possibility. Then it's always there, and communities look at that and see that, and young people who are called to ministry realize, well, it might be a rocky road, but maybe God is calling me to this. And as the church keeps baptizing people, there's a whole variety of people that get covered in that baptismal water, and they're growing up that the seeds in them can start to flourish more and more. And you don't get to just stomp it down. The life is going to keep emerging. And I think that's scary and hard and always trying, but it's also exciting, and it's the whole, you know, this tension has been with us a long time. You know, we have the biblical metaphor that you can't put old wine in a new wineskin. You got to get that new wine in a new wineskin so it can grow and ferment, and it's not going to burst the bag. And you know, growth and change has been part of our traditions for forever, and we've needed these metaphors to try to figure out how do we live with those tensions creatively, respectfully, and being aware that God keeps calling each generation, each person, that we have death, but we also have resurrection, transformation, and that's what we get to keep living into, that future, that hope.
If we stay with the wineskin bag metaphor for a second, you know, some people would say you have burst the bag. Churches are voting to leave the ELCA. What do you say about that? That you've helped, you know, destroy the church. I mean, I've heard some very strong mm-hmm. language about this.
Well, the church has had to live with tension since forever, and the Book of Acts is really just a history of the church fighting with itself. And you have St. Peter and St. Paul who really duked it out in Jerusalem. If you look at that council, what was that all about? And it was about, are we going to stay as insiders? We're Jewish people who believe in Jesus, and what does that mean to us? Or are we going to open this up to the outsiders, the Gentiles, the others? And are we going to have their practices and all those people change what we do? We're going to have to eat food differently. We're not going to be washing our hands and cleansing ourselves in the same way. And those laws of purity are going to break down. And all those things had to happen. You know, it went from what's the sign of inclusion is circumcision. No, now the sign of initiation and welcome is baptism. It's water that can touch not just men, but women and children and everybody. And so so the model just keeps moving out and out and out. And to say that we started this is just not true. For anybody who knows church history, this has been happening for a long time, but it's always difficult, and we've never set out to create conflict, but we also know that when you speak up and say your truth, that there will be resistance. And we also know that there are many, many people, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, their parents, their sisters and brothers, their cousins, who have said, you know, the church has been rejecting. The church has not been able to welcome us, and we've had to leave. And how many people has that been through the years? How many people have died in fear or shame because they thought the church was rejecting them rather than that there was a way that they could find welcome? And so we haven't created the beginning of that. That's been a dynamic that has been part of church for a long, long time, and we do not want to encourage the conflict, and it's very difficult when congregations go through that, but we also know that this is not going away, and congregations have to be looking at this and other issues of what does inclusion mean.
So are the two of you both from Minnesota? Okay. So, sort of. You know, you said you grew up here.
I grew up on the seminary campus.
Okay. And Phyllis, did you grow up in Minnesota too?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Okay. So you go to California, you answer this call, you're sort of in the you know, most famous part of this country for being out and being gay. And then you choose to come back to Minnesota. I'm curious about that, and now we're sort of coming full circle, that now it's mm-hmm. back in Minnesota where you're going mm-hmm. to have your rite of reception. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about why it was important to come back here?
Well, coming back here was a difficult decision to make, and it was really a variety of reasons, all of which I don't even have time to go into here. But we parent our daughter with a gay male couple who live in San Francisco and who are dear friends of ours. We were dear friends with them for 2 years before we decided to have a child together. And so it can truly be said that we have left a part of our hearts in San Francisco. And our daughter goes back there 2 or 3 times a year, and we try to get back there as often as possible. So it was a hard decision to leave and to know that we would be separating part of our family and making that move. But you have to know when the time is right to leave a parish situation that is as intense as that one was. And pastors who overstay situations and become too comfortable in them stop being able to be catalysts for change and growth. And so we pledged to ourselves early on that we would leave before that happened and not allow ourselves to be seduced by the fear of our prospects are more limited than other clergy because we're working outside the system. And we kept to that promise. And another factor that was weighing heavily on us was that the San Francisco is a city that is sadly losing its middle class. It's losing its families with children, and you can see that in the public education system. And the high cost of living there and the cost of the lack of affordable housing is really having devastating consequences on the city. Our life there was subsidized because we lived in the church's parsonage, and we knew that our life in San Francisco was subsidized, and that when the time came for our work at St. Francis to be over, and that we would probably have to relocate. And so when it just felt right that we had been there 15 years, and we were at the point at which we left, we were the senior pastors in the conference, in the sense that we had been there the longest time at that point. It was a very hard decision to make. And our daughter never ceases to remind us that she is a native San Franciscan, and we fully expect that she will probably relocate there again and reclaim her home. But our roots are here, and all of Phyllis's family is here, and so it was time for her to be closer to them, it was time to come back.
Well, it is interesting that there's, in some ways, a kind of more of a freedom on the coasts, and especially San Francisco is known for being a place of great freedom for a variety of people. So there's something kind of fitting about coming back here for this rite of reception that says, you know, this isn't just a fringe movement. It's not just a bunch of libertarians doing their own thing who don't really care about good order and process and all of that. And we have been diligent with the process here and have felt very welcomed and supported by the Synod. And it feels right that here we are. This is where we met. This is where we went to seminary. And kind of that Lutheran roots, why didn't we just, you know, leave the whole thing a long time ago, that there's something about this is our grounding. And so it's good that we're here, that it's come back full circle to this place and this time. And it's such an honor to be joining Anita Hill for this time with her her wide history of work in this movement and her open heart with all of this, that it's really an honor that Ruth and I can join Anita on this festive day and feel just truly welcomed.
But we are also proud to say that we are legally married in the state of California.
True.
And it's been very difficult to give up that legal recognition in coming to Minnesota and all of the implications of that for parenting. So it is a very mixed, it's with very mixed emotions that we left California and came back to Minnesota. And we, of course, are hoping that Minnesota catches up with California eventually and recognizes the marriages of GLBT people here.
I'm putting a lot of stock in your predictions, so I'm wondering how long do you
think Oh, no. Well, if Iowa can nudge its Minnesota neighbor, I am very proud of Iowa, and so I'm hopeful.
Ruth was born in Iowa, so you get to be proud.
I was born in Iowa. So I'm hopeful that with Iowa's leadership in this, that we can see legal recognition of marriage for GLBT people. I'm going to go out on a limb and say in the next 10 years.
Oh, be bold.
That is bold. Oh, I don't know. I really can't predict that. But it will happen. It will definitely happen.
Yeah. Ruth, what does the rite of reception mean to you?
I see it as throwing open the door to the next generation of seminarians who will not have to go through seminary closeted, and who may not have to live any part of their lives closeted, but who can claim their wholeness and the goodness of who they are as they live their lives. And so I don't personally need the rite of reception in order to do the work that I'm already doing, but I welcome it as a sign of very significant change in the church with respect to GLBT people. And so it is the fruit of 20 years advocacy and struggle and sorrow. And for some, for many, many have died before they could see this day. And those faces and voices will be with us September 18th. But hopefully they will be with us in joy. And so the ghosts of the past, you know, are still with us. But hopefully it can be all the saints rejoicing, you know, on this side and the other side together in this moment. And the work is not over. There's much to be done in the church. But it's important to take the time to celebrate what has happened, and to simply rejoice in it. And so I expect to be cheering along with the crowd that gathers that day, not only on my own behalf, but on behalf of so many people whose voices we have represented over the years and who can now claim their own voice.
I just want to pause for a second and make sure I have covered what I wanted to ask you.
Of course.
This has been just great. What year did you get married?
Oh man, we've tried to marry so many times.
Let's see. So when did we legally?
The legal marriage was August. See, we were part of that group that got married when the city hall when the county of San Francisco opened the door to legal marriage. We were part of the throngs of couples who waited in long lines at city hall to get married, only to have those licenses revoked a year or so later, mm-hmm. which was very disappointing. But when the door opened again
We got married August 2008.
Okay. In 2008, when the door opened again, we flew back to San Francisco, gathered up Noelle's, our daughter's dads and friends of ours, and got married yet again. And this has been our fourth ceremony. You know, the first ceremony was simply a ceremony with our church here in Minnesota and our friends. The second was when domestic partners benefits when domestic partners were established in the state of California, and we were part of that coming to be. And we registered as domestic partners at City Hall in San Francisco and had ceremonies of celebration on the steps of City Hall and officiated at a number of weddings there that day. So that was in 1991?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 1991. So we had our first church ceremony in 1986.
After being together 2 years.
Yeah. We had our domestic partners ceremony in 1991. We had our first legal marriage in 2003?
Six.
2004.
Sorry.
That was revoked. And then we had our fourth ceremony in 2008. And that so far has held.
In the state of California.
In the state of California. So, you know, the next area of change in the church will be full recognition of same-gendered partnerships. And, you know, the church is going to struggle with that, and they're not going to want to call it marriage. But you can, you know, you can pretend something doesn't exist by refusing to call it what it is, but it won't change the fact that it exists. And so that's going to be the next area of change, I think. And you know, sadly, the church seldom leads society. It tends to follow society. And so, and the secular society has been fitful at best with respect to recognition of GLBT people's rights. And so secular society is going to have to do better, and the church is going to have to do better. And hopefully they can partner with one another instead of drag on one another. And we are glad that a denomination as major as the Lutheran denomination is taking the lead. And I know that Presbyterians are taking heart as they see Lutherans taking the lead. And I know that it will be a catalyst for change with other denominations as well.
May I ask your ages?
I'm 62.
53.
And so... Ruth, you mentioned that the rite of reception, you know, it doesn't really change your career. I mean, now you technically would be eligible now to be called to any church that would now accept a gay pastor. But you don't think that either of you will take advantage of that, or?
Oh, you know, never say never. I don't close the door to parish ministry again, but I think the work that I'm doing as a chaplain with Hospice of the Twin Cities is as important a work as any parish work is. It's just a more intensely focused direction of ministry. So the question is not, you know, which one is more important. It's which one is the right call at this time in my life. And for right now, hospice chaplaincy is the right call.
And I would say the same thing. I feel very blessed in my work at Fairview Home Care and Hospice right now, and know that that's a good fit for me, know that God is using me there, know that that's real ministry. So it's not like I'm hoping to get back into real ministry. I'm doing that now, and in a different setting, but where the message of hope and healing is sometimes very urgent for certain people, and where families, I think, really take in memory and meanings, and things can come together in ways that really can be transformative for the rest of your life, that you can, it can move something in you. So I take that as a great blessing to be there now. And I'm open to what God has in store, and I'm glad that I have other opportunities that might not have been there before this rite of reception is going to happen. And I'm so glad that no one is wanting to call this another ordination. I stand on the power of that ordination 20 years ago that was called extraordinary only because it couldn't happen through the normal means. We had invited our bishop and all of that at that time. So I have been ordained, feel very ordained, and yet am very glad for this opportunity, for that to be recognized, and for this wider reception to happen. And I've felt very connected with the ELCA all through these years. Obviously, we've been a part of this struggle within the ELCA. We've also received great support and welcome through many channels within the ELCA. So it's not like this is where we haven't also been, but to have the full welcome now is really, it's really a gift right now, and it's something that I'm really eager to celebrate.
Also, hospice chaplaincy takes you into a wider world than the Lutheran Church can take you. You are meeting people where they are, and you are working in interfaith contexts and with people who may or may not have an affiliation with a congregation or a mosque or a synagogue, but who are exploring what their spiritual path means to them, and to be trusted to accompany them for a while at a key time in their life is a great honor, and it frees you from some of the politics of the church. And you're really talking about what is truly meaningful. I mean, I would love to get past being an issue in the church as a lesbian. I've been a professional Lutheran lesbian all my life. It's time to be, you know, meeting one another in deeper ways than that affords.
And how old is your daughter?
16.
16, okay. Let's see here.
She would have a lot to say to you.
Well, I'm wondering what her reaction is to the rite of reception.
We do.
I don't think we
okay.
need to.
Leave her out.
You could ask to interview her. She might be willing.
Well, I actually would love to interview her.
I mean,
her.
She's supportive, it's not that, but I still yeah. want to speak for her.
No, of course
she does not self-identify as.
Yeah. Okay.
Just like
her. Let's
see here. Oh, I guess, how do you change people's minds on this?
You know, I don't think you change people's minds by trying to persuade them to change their minds. I think you change people's hearts by speaking from the heart. When you speak from the heart, people listen from the heart. And I'm not so much interested in changing people's minds because I think that's kind of an exercise in futility. If we can meet in an area of common ground, if we can meet in a way that brings open-heartedness to the meeting, good things can happen. And you can't predict what direction that will go, but I have found that when love leads, understanding follows.
And I think we can seem so different from one another until we really start to talk about our own struggles. And there isn't a family that doesn't have a secret that they yearn to share with someone that they can trust and that they can really talk about the hurts and the hopes that we all have. And our difference is more obvious. It's more politically charged in many ways. People do a lot of negative fundraising around gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people and how scary we seem. So somehow there's a visibility to that difference that that feels electrifying for people. But the differences that we have are all among us, and the commonalities that we share are so much deeper. And so to get beyond just the stereotypes and to really meet each other as we are, I think there's no turning back from that. And I think as young people, we see the next generation not living the labels in the same way, not caring, not seeing how those labels even make sense with the fluidity of sexuality or, you know, racially, how do we identify ourselves? And they're really understanding that it's much more fluid, that we're a common humanity, that, you know, it's not central to who we are that has to divide us. And so again, I take heart that we keep moving and changing and growing, and we don't change one another's minds, but we enter into each other's fabric of our lives, and that enters us into the heart where we can really share the differences that will draw us together ultimately.
So one of the things I asked is whether you have hung on to your press clippings from all of the ink that's been spilled. I'm curious, I mean, you've been in documentaries, you've been the subject of newspaper articles, radio interviews.
You know, for archival purposes, we knew that we were part of something that would be historic. And so for archival purposes, yes, I did put together a series of albums that contain the press clippings and photographs and interviews. And they are in a box that I couldn't even tell you where that box was. It's in storage somewhere. And I did turn over some of that to the archival offices of what was then Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministries and has since become Extraordinary Lutheran Ministries. And they photocopied them. So I simply wanted to safeguard them for archival purposes, but I can tell you I have not looked at those in years. You know, we're living in the present, not the past.
To record about 30 seconds of the sound of your house. It helps me with my editing, so mm-hmm. If I can just do that.
Well, too bad the dog's the not house. Wailing.
Man, you had plenty of sounds to get done with.
Let's see, we'll do the groan for you.
Don't do that or you'll get her going.
Well, there was kind of a sad point when you were speaking and the dog was sort of weeping over in the corner.
Yeah.
Like, kind of on cue, but...
Oh, man. And of course they decide to play right in the middle of this.